Hello and welcome to Seize and Desist, the podcast. I'm delighted to be joined by Paul Radu, investigative journalist extraordinaire and someone that I have seen speaking at many different events over the years. And I've commented on the work that they do at OCCRP in terms of some of the articles and information they put out. So absolutely delighted that you've joined us today, Paul.
Thank you for the invitation, Aidan, and hi all.
So we wanted to sort of dive straight in and talk a little bit about sort of the perspectives that you've gathered as someone, you know, operating sort of in this space. You bring quite a unique perspective for yourself and for your organization, sort of looking at the world of illicit finance assets and the overall sort of asset recovery efforts. What is your view and take on all of this? You know, the infamous 1% of assets being recovered. You've written at length about the sheer scale of illicit money laundering. I would love to hear your perspective and just sort of framing how you describe to people what it is that you do and what you see in our sector.
Absolutely, Aidan. So indeed, I mean, at the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, the organization that I co-founded about 18 years ago, we're very much focused on identifying assets that belong to criminals, corrupt politicians, corrupt corporations, and such. Now, over the years, we've contributed to the recovery of about $11 billion from various bad parties, let's say. This includes all classes of assets, money, of course, and so. So this is a great return on investment when it comes to investigative reporting, because obviously our budgets were fairly small. And I think we're somewhere in between 30,000 to 40,000% return on investment. So that's a good number.
Crime pays.
Yeah, it seems so. But the reality of this is that what we've done is more of a proof of concept. I mean, I'm very proud of our work. This is, I think, amazing work, and I'm proud to be working with very courageous people all over the world, amazing investigative reporters who know how to follow the money, who know how to track down the asset, and to follow the infrastructure and to expose the infrastructure that allows for this massive theft and massive kind of takeover of assets all over the place. But at the end of the day, we're talking about $11 billion over 18 years, when we know that according to NASDAQ, the UN, there's, about $3 trillion every year in kind of illicit finance. And I think even that is a low number. But let's say it's just $1 trillion per year. Let's downside that,
I was going to say, because I would make the argument for 6 or 7, but yeah.
So let's go to $1 trillion a year. Now, we know at OCCRP that criminals love real estate. And, a big part, I think the biggest chunk of the money that they make every year goes into real estate, and goes into not just the posh villa in London or the mansion in Surrey, in the south of London, or the south of France, or New York, or Miami. It goes into buying, forest surfaces, water surfaces, just land, all over the place. So and many other classes of assets. So if we take just $1 trillion per year, and we say half of that is invested in real estate, over the past 3-4 decades, that's a lot of assets, like a lot. So a lot of real estate. I say that in some countries, the criminals own the ground beneath the people's feet. So that is something where, as investigative reporters, we managed to prove some of that, but we never had the scale to show what really is going on. I mean, you look at housing crisis all over the place, and I believe October last year, I was on my way to Asuncion, to Paraguay, and I made a stopover for one day in Madrid, and it was a Saturday. So I was in the center of Madrid in Spain, and I saw these tens of thousands of people taking to the streets of Madrid, protesting the housing crisis in that city. And you know, they were blaming the government, they were blaming the ministry,
tourists, Airbnb and tourists.
I've not seen anyone blaming the criminals. I mean, the criminals
must
have bought a lot of assets, because what they were carrying, some of the signs says that there's a lot of empty property in the city. Now, that empty property is usually the sign that criminals, organized crime, corrupt politicians made investments, because the reality of this of these people is that they don't like to work, right? So even but they like to store assets, you know, in real estate. So they wouldn't even put those assets, you know, those buildings, those apartments, you know, on apps to sell them
They don't even care about renting them. It's just the accumulation of assets.
Exactly. It's just the accumulation of assets. So I was there and I was thinking, oh my God, these people should know about what's really going on, because we've investigated real estate in Spain, and we know that a lot of it is owned by, you know, corrupt oligarchs from Russia, for instance. But there's a lot more than that we don't know. So from Madrid, I went to Asunción. And guess what? In Asunción, you have the Paraguay River running, you know, like adjacent to the capital of Paraguay. And there are lots of people living in these huts, you know, like in really, really bad conditions. And these were people displaced from their lands in this territory of Paraguay called El Chaco, that was taken over by people, you know, having cattle, and also people, you know, that were involved in drug trafficking on that border with Brazil, mostly. So I was looking at that as well. And you go to Asunción, to the center, and you see these high rises that sit there empty. You know, it's pretty
the
amazing.
Beautiful glass palaces.
Yeah, and you take the housing crisis all over the place. I mean, there's housing crisis in every capital, you know. Yeah. In the world. So I'd say that the percentage of that is because of these investments by the criminals. So this is where, you know, I believe we should really think about this very, very hard, because without a massive effort on the side of journalism, activism, law enforcement, politics, you know, everybody, you know, who has a stake in this, this housing crisis will just deepen, the assets of the criminals will just grow, and people will be left without any place to live at the end of, or any place to grow their crop, let's say, you know, or any water and such. So the accumulation is pretty huge, in my opinion, and there's need for a global asset recovery effort, like truly global. Where capital cities coordinate with each other, where you go massively against data sets like property databases, and you identify these assets, and you issue laws that allows for the confiscation, for the seizure, for the confiscation of these assets. So that's, in my mind, something that needs to happen, because without this, it's not just the housing crisis. The moment the criminal sees a lot of land in a place, they actually seize a lot of power. Land is power, you know. It's just in the legend of Antaeus from ancient Greek. I mean, you gotta take these people off the ground, you know. You gotta uproot them, because otherwise, you know, they have a say in the local politics, in the local governance, in all these places. And this is, you know, I mean, it's a price we're paying right now with the rising populism. The power that these people have is because they managed to accumulate, you know, huge volumes of assets.
It's a really, really interesting perspective. It's something that I was involved at a launch, an economic crime summit with Roussi, and a UK MP, I'll dig out his name and attach it in the show notes, but he was very outspoken about, you know, illicit finance and, you know, flows going through London. And I think his area that he was the, you know, elected official for covered something like, you know, Chelsea or Kensington. And he had a running joke about the fact that, you know, turn the lights on, because they had so many multi-million pound properties that were completely vacant. And no, someone went in and did basic cleaning and maintenance once every 3-6 months. That was the height of it. And literally, he said, entire streets where there was maybe one person living there. So you had a street that was possibly worth £1 million per property. But because of the buoyant criminal market, prices now are 1.5, 1.7, 2. So the person that actually is a wealthy doctor or family who wants to move to London and wants to buy that property, they're being outcompeted. And as you say, there's then this wider, and I'm sure it's been replicated around the world. The UK did a study into the wider impact of serious and organized crime to say it's not just about the drug dealing or the trafficking. There's a cost to policing. There's a cost to the conviction. There's the downstream effect when the child whose father is arrested, what life that child is likely to take, and just all of the things that continue off this. If the illicit finance or the crime is the black hole, just all the other things that get sucked in, because then someone's going to move that money. And then you've got things like the low-level money launderers and the mules who are shipping the stuff and going on a plane from London to Dubai with a suitcase. I mean, that's not someone who has made good life choices. But again, they wouldn't have that job being offered to them if there wasn't that coordinator actually moving this around. I mean, you hit on a point that I want to bring you back to, was around this global concerted effort. We'll talk about sort of FATF and regulations and talk about that in a second. But as someone who's actually been in that seat where you've had to look at large data sets to pull together these reports, what is it in your what's your theory on, why isn't that governments that have resources and people and tools and technology, why are we not seeing the same level of, it always seems to me that investigative journalists have to do that grand reveal, get it on a front page news, get the moral public outrage, and then something happens. Now, as someone who's ex-law enforcement, I know that there isn't the resources, systematic funding cuts all the time means that we can't go after all the cases all the time. But is there more to that in your opinion? Is it political will? Is it, or what do you see as the main reason? Because I could understand that some might think that you'll not necessarily have the same borders or restrictions. You can truly follow the money as an investigator. But if you were leading, if you were a law enforcement chief or a politician, and what would you need to see in your city to be able to replicate that joined up approach to saying, okay, we've got an empty vacant property. Let's look into that. Let's look at the intel and the SARs around that. Let's look at that network. Why is it that we're not seeing what you guys do being replicated in the public sector?
Well, I asked this question with law enforcement officials from several countries, over time. And one of the answers I got was that, well, we cannot go fishing like you.
Yeah.
And that is the reality of it, right? In order to mount a case, to start an investigation, you need cause, you need a complaint, you need something tangible. So I think that's a big part to the problem. That's why I think there needs to be political will. Mm-hmm. To start these larger investigations that are not necessarily police investigations. They may be at first just like the city, like the capital city deciding, well, we need to, find out how much property sits empty, in our city. And what are the focal points where this happens, and what's really going on there? So, and that may turn later into a law enforcement investigation when the proper information is in place, and when maybe complaints can be filed on the basis of what was gathered initially. But even with this, this is an effort. What we're doing at OCCRP and what other networks are doing around the world is we're working between data sets. And mm-hmm. data sets are always like, some national data sets from this particular country. Some are cross-border data sets. But then you get into data sets from a second and third and fourth country. And to subpoena those data sets and to go through the official channels to file MLATs and all of that, that's as you very well know, a very, very time-consuming process. And for that, you have to have cause, and you have to justify the request to the other government in a very compelling way. So I think that's where some of the problems are. Plus, what you pointed out to. I mean, let's say you have a lot of investment coming now to London from Egypt. Now, will there be political will in Egypt to help you to find out what's behind that that investment? Well, probably not if those people investing in London from Egypt are connected with the government. And I'm just using Egypt right now.
It
might be just any other country. So the political will is part of it. And this comes down to the fact that what I was saying before, the criminals have grown their power. Because these assets mean a lot of political power. They have, you know, a big say in the local politics in many countries. So they dictate what gets shared, what doesn't get shared. Like you take a country like Paraguay that unfortunately is very corrupt on the back of the huge drug trafficking that goes across the country. And there are instances that we've seen where other countries were requesting information from Paraguay, and Paraguay was asking the people who were the subjects of the investigations, you know, to supply the information. And this was their way to inform them that, look, there's something going on. So obviously, you know, the level of trust between countries, between law enforcement agencies is sometimes very, very low. And this is why I think the approach needs to be a lot different. This has to be a local initiative from the local mayor, from the local politicians, you know, something that they can actually use for their political campaigning as well. I mean, taking back what belongs to the community is something that should be in everybody's interest.
It absolutely baffles me. I have given evidence in Parliament on this topic. I have talked and I always use the COVID example, that during COVID, when there is political will, we can receive daily updates of how many people have been vaccinated on any given day. Like that level of granularity is possible. And people are marching and rioting when certain things happen and they don't like the outcome. And I always use the example, well, if that's you at, you know, 7 or 8 out of 10 outrage, like you should be a 10 out of 10 for, you know, illicit finance and money laundering and asset recovery, because this literally is your money. I mean, even as someone who knows a resident in the UK, I mean, I live in Wales. I mean, my council tax bill shows me how much goes to the police and crime commissioner, you know, an elected role. And as you say, why there isn't, and again, is it political will? Because, I mean, I could be a pessimist and say, no, no politician would run on that ticket because they know they'll get no support from other politicians. No, virtually every country in the world has struggled with, you know, anti-corruption measures unless there's a complete wholesale, you know, adoption of a new way. Like we see in the UK, you know, the creation of an anti-corruption unit, but it's for overseas. How many investigations and arrests have we seen after, you know, misuse of COVID funds and that? And I think that there needs to be people, you know, with pitchforks going, where the hell is our money? I mean, why are we not recovering these assets more aggressively or using? And it's not the police, it's not even the prosecutors. It is at a, you know, a political sort of level where we've seen that there just hasn't been the support in the highest courts in the land when the really big decisions happen that affect all of the decisions downstream. So, I mean, what is your view on that? Is it, you know, it always, there's that scale of, you know, corruption to incompetence, but hiding somewhere in the middle, you know, looking a little bit like you just don't have your, you know, stuff together, whereas actually it's quite deliberate, having a slightly broken system. I know I can go down that conspiracy theory route on X, that it's all very deliberately contrived. I mean, you've been in this space for so long. What do you see as the good and the bad, and, you know, what's the recurring themes that you see that,
You know, there's conspiracies and conspiracies. And when we speak about criminals, I mean, criminals are very creative in creating real conspiracies. Yeah. you know, they're putting together, you know, I started investigating many years ago, these laundromats, which were these pipelines designed for massive money laundering. Mm. At first, when I was mentioning these to people, they would say, no, this is crazy. This is not
ridiculous. Yeah.
And I said, no, this is very well organized and it's offered to multiple organized crime groups at the same time. And people are saying, no, this is not possible, until we showed with
data
that this was possible and this was what was going on. So I think, you know, the problem here is how we look at the data that would help us, you know, identify the issue overall. Like, When we're saying housing crisis, we're usually looking at the pricing, you know, that went up, and we see this as something normal because, you know, all the prices went up, inflation went up, you know, and all of this. And then of course, there's more people, you know, around us, and, you know, that makes for more property being bought and so on and so on. But the reality is a bit different than that, because especially in Europe, you know, the population is aging. You know, in many countries, the population decreased in numbers, and still there's a huge housing crisis. So you're like, what's going on here? Well, one of the issues is that we don't really have a clear image, a focused image of what is going on. So, you know, for many years, including in the UK, there was this movement for transparency. You take the company's house, you take property records, you take all these other places, and you say, well, we put the data online. And that's fine. That's great. You know, that led to
a good start.
Good investigative reporting. It's a great start. But it's time we change this and we go to make data transparent in the public interest. And with the new technologies that we have around us, with LLMs and all of this, this is easy to do. What I'm talking about is not just say, well, you can always check a company in, you know, this registry, or you can always check an offshore that owns property in the UK. But these databases need to be unified, and they need to give you at all times, you know, a clear view of what is going on. How many formation agents have formed companies today? How many of those companies have bought property today? How many have bought property in the past? How much property? Where is the property? You know, like layers and layers and layers of information that would help politicians and law enforcement and journalists and activists and everybody and citizens, you know, make informed decisions based on that transparency, that is real transparency, quality transparency, not just a data dump somewhere on a website.
Yeah, because there is that, I mean, I've seen that firsthand where, I mean, there's transparency is great if it's actioned. I mean, we all know about the formation agent above a Chinese takeaway in London that has registered 60,000 companies, and every single company that's ever been, you know, arrested or prosecuted is illegal. Therefore, one could assume it wouldn't be a big stretch that the next one they register is probably going to be another illicit enterprise. And I think that's what we might see in terms of the new FATF guidance that's coming out, where it's about effectiveness in asset recovery. Now, what we're hoping to see is that trickles down into the assessments of saying it's not, I mean, I think where crypto and blockchain analytics have been a good thing is that they've presented a good playbook. Because when you speak to someone who works in crypto compliance, they're immediately thinking about, you know, joining all of the dots.
Right.
And all of the companies are, you know, in an arms race together to present the most actionable data as quickly as possible. And it's saying this address controls this address, and it's likely that this address on a 50% probability is this person who did this thing. And you can just jump on it. And I think that's where we're hoping to get to in the wider asset recovery piece. But like you say, this has been around for so long, and it's getting so much, it feels like it's getting so much bigger and more complicated and more intertwined. I worry that if it was in the too difficult bucket, like, again, I can think on one hand how many standalone money laundering investigations have been carried out. And I always remember someone who I'll not name, who works in the United Nations, that just talked about, I mean, it's the classic sort of media, you know, if it bangs or bleeds. He says money laundering investigations take longer than election cycles.
Right.
This is why you're not going to get someone. No one's going to get elected on they disrupted this thing. It says because the length of time it would take them to start and end that project. So we'll always default to guns, drugs, immigration. Someone said recently at an event we were speaking at, says, I can assure you the people in small boats coming across to the country is a problem, but they're not buying a £15 million new apartment in Kensington.
Absolutely. But speaking about the people, the citizens, I think that's where we would kind of hit the sweet spot in this type of at least asset identification. And for instance, as I mentioned, I'm very proud of our work at OCCRP, but at the end of the day, you have about 10,000 investor reporters in the world. And that's a very small number compared to the issue, to the problem. So this is where we need to go more towards the citizens. This is why I'm talking about the authorities, the public officials, putting together these data sets, making going from this transparency 2.0 kind of effort, where it's not just separate isolated data sets, but data sets that are connected, data sets where the citizen in the south of London can ask questions of the data set to find out why they don't have access to water, you know, that day, or why, you know, and so on. So the idea is, you know, to kind of up the game considerably and to allow the citizens to ask these questions and the citizens to put the pressure on the local law enforcement to go for the asset recovery efforts, because this is another issue. There are very few law enforcement that are truly specialized in asset recovery. And as you pointed out just now, these are processes that take, you know, like a very, very long time because they're not accompanied by the political will to do so. Mm-hmm. Now, if this becomes more grassroots, if the asset recovery effort becomes more like connected to the citizens and the citizens say, well, no, I mean, you gotta, you know, do this type of work because I'm paying you, you know, that's something that will change perhaps slowly the game, but it would make these efforts a lot more efficient. Right now, I mean, people are going after the big, you know, oligarch, Russian oligarch, because there's a sanction package in place. But then you also take into account the fact that they can hire some of the best lawyers, and those best lawyers are going to find the best loopholes for their people, and so on and so on. And you know, we found places where, you know, there's like in Germany, for instance, there were some assets that we identified there belonging to a Ukrainian Russian oligarch, and the oligarch was literally registering the property to an entity that said, in the case I'm sanctioned, you know, the property will go to a different name. And that's, you know, and he had like several names listed there so that he wouldn't be tied anymore to the problem. So they take into account all these types of moves by the law enforcement that are anyway slow. And even us as journalists, we are slow in what we do and we don't have the scale. But I think where we can change a little bit how things stand is if we consider ourselves more as a research and development place where we find these patterns and then innovation lab. Others. Yeah. To kind of take over the investigation and scale it up and do it better. But that, in my opinion, can only be done with local authorities, with the citizens in place, with someone who has a direct stake in this.
I think, and I love that idea, because we talk a lot on round tables about, you know, public and private sector partnership, and it gets wedged into every agenda at every event in the world. And usually, you know, lacks definition. No one really understands what it is or what good looks like. And I know there's been lots of examples of, you know, the banks submitting information and some, you know, sharing intelligence that has worked very well in the past. It seems I like this idea of actually public and private sector partnership, you know, being that, you know, you can fish and allowing and having funding for public interest initiatives that can go and make inquiries, you know, within reason of open source data sets and looking and saying, no, there is a, you know, large penthouse flat owned by a, you know, corporation overseas that hasn't had a resident in it for 2 years. The local council should be empowered to take enforcement action or say, no, you don't fit the profile. And I that sort of takes me to the point of, I mean, the accountability piece you talked about, again, the blueprint for asset recovery for me exists very well in crypto, because we're seeing highlighting the ROI is leading to investment in asset recovery. Because people are now saying, well, I can go and grab that $1 million, forfeit that $1 million in illicit assets and invest that in my operations. There's a clear sort of feedback loop. But I think that the other parallel I would draw is that there is a accountability problem, that it's when we talk about how much assets are seized and a government says, we seized $400 million this year. We always say, of what? No one ever talks about the of what. And I think that in the private sector, in terms of insolvency, there is a built-in accountability. So if I'm an insolvency practitioner tomorrow and I get pointed over a portfolio and I'm getting paid a good day rate and I'm recovering assets, I have to account to the creditors and I'm held accountable. And the creditors can sack me, the creditors can argue about my fees, and the creditors can push me and say, what about that last Lamborghini? Why did you not get that back? And I have to explain and go into it. And I think that there's almost a possibility of an intersection where you have this public and private sector, no transparency initiative, taking the data saying, we know that in your borough, the illicit finance is X. Yes. And then measure that against, and here's all you've recovered. Exactly. And then you do have like the town hall asking the mayor,
exactly,
what are you doing about it? Whereas I don't think we have that accountability. If I sit and have a conversation with my parents about a criminal, they can probably tell me what they did. They can probably tell me how many years they got convicted in prison. They can probably tell me about the big assets that were seized. But if I say, how much did we as like you know, global citizens, how much did we get back? It's just that the figure's not talked about. And yeah, it's probably not talked about because of years of underperformance and lack of investment. But I do think there's an opportunity now with, and it's an interesting flip that, I mean, the biggest seized asset by value now is crypto, far and away.
Yep.
Just by an absolute country mile because of the sheer amount of $1 billion crypto seizures recently. And I think that crypto is almost even less political because it's so blatantly tainted. Like when it's bad, it's bad.
Right.
So
right.
The example we often use is it's like me putting in a SAR as someone working in a crypto company. And then I say, there's a big bag of cash in the airport with guns and narcotics. Can the owner come forward? And that's what it's like when an exchange says there's crypto assets that have high exposure to illicit sites. It's so easy for local law enforcement to just freeze it, hold it for 12 months and say, come forward and prove this is legitimate. And they don't come forward. So we're seeing these big windfalls. And obviously the hope is this gets invested into more asset recovery initiatives. But what do you think needs to happen then to sort of to see that right through? Is it the same sort of public accountability in terms of tracking the recoveries? Or what do you think would happen as a practitioner in terms of this new FATF legislation and focus on asset recovery? What do you think some of the hurdles might be to that? Or success, or if you're optimistic?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, there needs to be like a push effort to kind of, you know, do a sweep of, look, this is the problem in this country, in this city, in this region, on this continent. And then, you know, pinpoint to that, you know, and inform the public about that, put some pressure there so that the public goes to their local authorities, to their local law enforcement, you know, to put as much pressure and to ignite as much action as possible. And you're also right in the sense that, you know, the power of the criminals is their secrecy, right? The fact that they can hide so effectively, so efficiently. But that is also their weakness. So we gotta use that more against this type of people. I mean, if you manage to find out, you know, that, you know, this thousand of hectares of land, you know, is owned by, you know, an Italian mafia group, and you seize it, again, it's the chance that they will come forward saying, well, this is our land and, you know, we got to hire lawyers and we got to fight you and all of that. I mean, they might do that, but the fight will be easy too. Yeah. You know? So I think there's need, first of all, for this acknowledgement that the issue is huge, that we're talking about trillions invested every year into all these classes of assets, and that we're losing not just the assets themselves, but the effect of that, the impact of those assets goes beyond just the assets themselves. It's really a lot of political power that goes with them. So I guess quantifying that in a very conservative way, mm-hmm. you know, would make a huge difference. But for this, we need to have the vision to be able to go against systemic kind of asset kind of accumulation, and to understand it, and to understand the implications that come with that. So I think once we outline those as journalists, as the private sector, as law enforcement, as politicians, I think that's when things will change, because otherwise what we're doing is piecemeal, really.
Yeah.
Even that is not efficient.
We need to cast
a very wide net, you know, to catch as much fish there and to make sure, you know, that the big fish stays in. So
it's a very good point, and it's something that, I mean, I've worked in like civil insolvency and bankruptcy case, and I mean, I stand by my continued statements that I feel that we treat ordinary citizens in debt worse than we do serious and organized criminals. When we think that, and what I mean by that is when we think about, I mean, most jurisdictions, I mean, there's legislation that if the boat contains drugs, it's an instrumentality of crime. You can seize the boat. Right. And that's not up for debate in a good way. But often if you buy the yacht, or you buy the Ferrari, you buy the Birkin bag or the Hermes bag, then it's an element usually of some sort of monetary order, extended confiscation that goes after these, you know, ill-gotten gains. So then it all of a sudden becomes a financial recovery. And I remember, I've been through this so many times, where I've been acting as an asset management contractor, and in one hand I have a bankruptcy order, and the bankruptcy order literally allows the insolvency practitioner to change the locks on the house. Right. Without the consent. It allows me to, you know, they can apply to court, freeze the bank account, shut down a trading business, literally take stuff off the driveway of the house without consent.
Right.
And only reasonable things like leaving them the tools of the trade. They have five cars and they've got to do a school run. Leave them the old clapped out car to do the school run. You're taking everything else. And this could be someone that just in a supply chain, the business above him collapsed. He hasn't got paid, done nothing wrong.
Yep.
And we do that. But then I'm sitting that afternoon in London and I'm in a confiscation court. And I've seen this played out all around the world, where it's a case of, you know, career criminal with a organized crime rap sheet, you know, that a gangster novel would be proud of, who doesn't want to sell his Range Rover, is defending his case and his civil liberties. And I've even heard, you know, some of the lawyers talk about, you know, the human rights and, you know, right to personal property. And you're going, like, cocaine, 4 kilos of cocaine was found in his house, for example. And he gets to enjoy the speedboat and the house in Marbella, and he's locked up in remand, but his entire family gets to enjoy the Range Rovers until the case is concluded. 3 years later, the house is in ruin. The car is in ruin. And it's, as you said, they know how to play the system. And I keep thinking that, is it a case of, I mean, this role of, you know, professional enablers in a lot of this? I mean, we just saw the big case in Singapore where, you know, one of the biggest money laundering investigations, phenomenal result, lots of assets seized, lots of physical assets seized.
Yep.
But once again, I see the, you know, the Hermes bags, the Birkin bags, the artwork, the, you know, the gold bars and everything else. And what are your views as an investigative journalist in this space? Like, back to my, you know, civil debtor case versus the criminal. And then the criminal gets to hide behind the legislation that was designed for innocent people who are falsely accused, like benefit of the doubt legislation. You alluded to it earlier on, where investigative journalists are afraid to write certain things because these aggressive, often London law firms will, you know, protect these absolute horrible human beings. Like, let's call a spade, horrible, well-known human beings.
Absolutely.
And they're protected. So is it a case of, like, if you're king for a day, is it a case of, we need to change the rules that if you're the law firm that represents one of these people and they're found, and I know I'm getting into a whole, you know, criminal justice arena here, but I think it's a conversation we need to have. You shouldn't be able to make all of your fees defending this horrible human being and then keep all your fees, walk away, and then they get found guilty or not. Like, I get the right to a free trial, but that doesn't mean you should be able to spend your billions that you illegally accumulated on the best law firms in the world. and aggressively shut down investigative journalists and aggressively shut down authors, aggressively shut down. The reason this podcast is called Cease and Desist is because a very well-known international law firm served a cease and desist letter on us because we dared help the Ukrainian government consider selling a sanctioned asset. Consider. We weren't even appointed and we got a cease and desist letter. Yeah. Like, the system is just not fair in the good guy trying to get assets back.
I mean, I think a lot of the laws are dated. And we've seen, for instance, the case of like years ago when we investigated the laundromats, how these Scottish limited partnerships were used.
Oh, yeah.
Like, for money laundering. That's an example of a law. I think the law was issued in the 1800s or something like that, like a long, long time ago. And criminals, with the help of their enablers, with the help of the criminal services industry, lawyers, probation agents.
No one found that online and just decided to explore that. That was a scheme that was sold to them.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So that's an example. I mean, like, And criminals will always be very resourceful when it comes to using the law to their advantage. I mean, we're seeing this all over the place.
But don't put it on a plate for them.
In many, many, many ways. So that's where laws need to be updated. Yeah. That's where laws need to be unified across continents. Because without this, criminals are free to operate. Because even if something is seized in the UK, you know, something that belongs to a criminal group, trust me, they have probably a lot more assets, you know, outside of the UK. They have a lot more that they can amass, you know, elsewhere. So they will still, stay powerful, even if you put in jail a few of them. So I think it's time for this massive asset recovery global effort, you know, to go against this type of issues. And it's time for us to reevaluate the laws. I mean, everybody's for privacy. Everybody is for, you know, property is sacred, sure, you know. Yeah. But why is property bought with the tears, you know, on the back of so many victims, you know, sacred, you know? That's like, the victims should have access to that property, not the criminal.
Funny on that point, because I think a lot of, you know, non-Europeans will maybe not appreciate that. I think I like the examples that most British people and Irish people would be sort of horrified if they thought that their neighbor could look up their tax return and could see what they earned or see how they voted. But many European jurisdictions, like post World War II and post, you know, dealing with fascism and things like that, they, you know, brought in these huge reforms. And the argument was always, yes, it may feel like an infringement on your personal civil liberties, but it's necessary because we cannot have this happening again. In the same way, yeah, Lewis Hamilton should be able to drive a car 100 miles per hour, but he can't. He has to abide by the speed limit that exists to all of us. And I do think that it is one of these things. My personal belief is in 40, 50 years, we'll look back and go, remember the Wild West days when you could just buy a big house in London through a shell corporation? I do think that even the former politicians, former prime ministers of the UK have used the same system to buy properties in England. And my personal belief is that, and I would love to know what your thoughts are, but I mean, I think we are just systemically failing at holding the professional enablers to account. I think that until we are prosecuting the accountants, the lawyers, the real estate agents, the bankers, the everyone involved, the crypto exchanges that, like, we're not talking, and that's what my personal pet peeve is, when people think that the governments that went after crypto exchanges are going after crypto. No, they're going after people who made billions in sanctions evasions for things like Iran,
absolutely,
for things like Syria. Like, it's not it's bad against Bitcoin. And I hate the way they, the woe with me that, no, they're attacking me because it's crypto. No, you're laundering.
Yeah.
Laundering's not good. But then I understand why they complain, because they're like, I don't see many people from HSBC and Danske and Goldman Sachs in prison for 10 or 20 year sentences.
There's one from Danske. The CEO is convicted.
But what I mean is, but we can talk about one or two.
Yeah,
we should be talking about thousands over the last. I think it's one. Yeah. And I think there, in the Danske, there was four or five acquitted. And the same with, you know, HSBC and the Sinaloa cartel. And even now, the big crypto exchanges. I can rhyme off the ABCs of the big crypto exchanges. And on, in their early years of building billions, just had no compliance controls in many instances. No. And it's kind of like, and I think there needs to be a shock to the system for people to be like, I will not do that going forward.
That is crucial, because without that, because that kind of jolt, you know, yeah, to the system, you know, nothing will happen. And au contraire, things will become worse, because the more accumulation of assets, the more accumulation of political power, the less we will be able to do against criminals. So this is where, you know, we have to acknowledge the problem, you know, and act in a big, big way for it, you know, because otherwise, you know, we'll have more crises, more war. I mean, look, my opinion on the war in Ukraine, the Russian invasion in Ukraine, is that a lot of it is due to assets that are owned by oligarchs, Ukrainian and Russian, very corrupt the oligarchs, both in Russia and Ukraine. And they had an interest in igniting this conflict that maybe got offhand, you know, at some point, but it's really their interest, you know, their drive to keep the political power, to control everything, to allow for their, you know, money laundering and all. I mean, Kyiv was money laundering central until 2014. You know,
I was there on projects with UN and with the EU Anti-Corruption Initiative, working on projects to, you know, to be one of the many thousands of contractors that were involved in trying to deal with the reform. And they created an asset recovery and management agency. It has been through something like six or seven heads of agency in the 6 or 7 years that we've known them and tracked it. And an incredibly complicated place before the invasion. And I do think that, and perhaps we could quickly touch on it, as we, and I already promised you this would take 30 minutes and I knew we would talk for longer. It's great. But I think that what would be a useful way to sort of to round out is the excellent report that you did in Dubai, because what stood out to me the most is that when I talk to anybody about money laundering and cash and properties and assets, there seems to be this misconception that, but it's now moving into other stuff. And what struck me the most was, you know, this was like 2022, 2023, and the interplay of cash and crypto. It's not that we're moving into crypto, forgetting about real estate, forgetting about illicit finance. It's not one or the other. And it's certainly not, oh, that's what it was like back in 2010 and 2015. And, you know, things are getting better. Like, if you could maybe give us a bit of a brief overview, but how recent, I mean, this particular activity in your journalism was?
No, I mean, this is something that happens now as we speak. There are places on earth like Dubai that are condoning this type of activities, of criminal activities, and they welcome, you know, criminals parking their money there in the Emirates. So we did Dubai Unlocked in 2024, actually, and we worked with very recent data at that point in time. But, you know, I mean, we're looking now at cases connected to Dubai. It's the same thing that goes on, because this is it, and it's interesting. People, when they look at crime, they look at kind of at a phenomena that come and go. You know, it's like, okay, so now we have this type of crime, tomorrow we'll have this other, this will vanish somewhere in the ether, and that's not true. I mean, crime stays, crime lives, crime thrives. You know, if a criminal method is lucrative, it will be applied over and over and over again.
It'll be a rinse and repeat.
And money laundering is very lucrative for many types of people, for the criminals themselves, for the enablers, for everybody. And parking that money into assets, you know, from crypto assets to real estate to everything, it's extremely lucrative. And people love, and criminals love, and I've interviewed hundreds of criminals over my career. And when I started, actually, I was going jail by jail to speak with criminals to find out why are they doing this and how are they doing this, you know.
Wow.
And this was, to me, was very, very revealing. This was about 20 years ago. But the reasoning is the same. If I speak today to a criminal, it's going to be the same reasoning like 20 years ago when I went jail by jail. And it's like, people love tangible assets.
Yeah.
you know, they love to put their hands on something. They love to the idea of owning something, you know, and that's not going to be.
It is the most like anthropological, like wired into owning chattels, owning it. It is the roof above your head. It represents safety. It represents wealth, success.
And that's not necessarily going to be an NFT. But it might be a smart contract that gives them ownership of a real property in London, you know.
Look, it's something maybe, Paul, it'll be for a future episode for you to start tracking, because, I mean, again, I'm a big fan of technology. And I mean, the tools we're developing here is to combat, you know, this and make it easier to seize assets. But I'm also looking over my shoulder with a bit of terror, thinking we're about to see, as we're talking today, Ethereum's at an all-time high. Bitcoin is at pretty much at an all-time high. Bitcoin was an all-time high last night. And you've now got the tokenization taking place. So we already have a existing system with real estate and physical assets and existing payment rails, MasterCard and Visa and all of those things. We've all of that has trillions of reasons why we should be concerned about money laundering. And now we're taking an additional technology layer to make it even more open 24/7. But with my note of optimism is the fact that the track and trace technology and the ability to seize digital assets and the footprint that it leaves with IP attribution means that we can go after those assets. But as you've highlighted in your many reports, just because we can doesn't mean we do. As a global society,
but we should, and we have.
But we to, should, yeah, yeah,
and we have to, and we really need to start up this global asset recovery effort, you know, against criminals, because they just accumulated too much power, and the only way for people to be able to carry on with their lives, you know, around the world is if they will have a lot more access to the assets that belong to them at the end of the day. And so I think there's need for a concerted effort on our side where we use what we've done this far and we develop the new technology, we develop the new data sets, we develop the new strategies, you know, between sectors to be able to become a lot more efficient against the criminals.
One of the big, most positive initiatives I see is when governments, even in a very small local level, it happened in the UK, Lancashire Police, from the back of a crypto seizure. You know, governments demonstrating the effectiveness of asset recovery by reinvesting the forfeited proceeds in the jurisdiction. So whether that's buying football pitches with floodlights for kids in disadvantaged areas, or funding education and awareness against scams, or just physically paying for more police officers, more training, more tools. I think that's a very powerful message, because if people see that investment and there was that overall accountability that says we've got 1% back of, and we're currently working towards getting that up each year, then that would be maybe creating that sort of that level of accountability that we need to see.
Absolutely. And we need that accountability for sure.
Well, let's hope that we can speak again in a couple of years. We'll see after the new round of evaluations where FATF is now going to be targeting the effectiveness of asset recovery. So I hope we're sitting here. I hope you're out of a job in a nice way, because there's no more money laundering. But I somehow doubt that.
I honestly hope so too. And I hope citizens will be able to represent their interests much, much better through investigative tools.
Wonderful. Paul, thank you so much for your time. We'll include in the show notes the Dubai report, which for me was one of the most insightful, interesting pieces of investigative journalism I've ever read. So keep up the amazing work, and we'll include a little bit about OCCRP. You know, you receive funding from around the world from different government agencies to keep sort of fighting the good fight. And yeah, let's check in again in the future and see. We'll get an update on your progress.
Thank you all. Thanks.
Thank you.
Our podcasts are for informational purposes only. They are not intended to provide legal, tax, financial, and/or investment advice. Listeners must consult their own advisors before making any decisions on the topics being discussed.